Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Today, though, this is a public talk, so besides conference participants, we have people from outside the university. That's one of the contributions NYU offers to the UE. We offer public talks, and everybody can come and enjoy. We found the opportunity to get Nadia here to talk to the public and to the conference. So she has this difficult job to cater both to non-experts and experts, and see how this goes. A few words about Nadia. She's an associate professor in computer science and engineering in the University of California, San Diego. Her research focuses on mathematical empirical cryptanalysis of public key crypto, and that's actually the title of the talk. She's the recipient of the NSF Career Award, which prestigious in the US, multiple Best Paper Awards from CCS and Usenix Security, and the Test of Time Award from Usenix. From 2013 until 2018, she was an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and she received a PhD in computer science 2011 from Princeton and spent time as a postdoc and visiting researcher at UC San Diego and Microsoft Research, New England. Nadia, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. This is very exciting. It's my first time here. So this talk is about mathematical cryptanalysis in the real world, which is going to be very general in some sense. So I figured I would start by making it somewhat concrete what I want to talk about. So here I've put the cartoon diagram of a generic cryptographic protocol handshake, which is intended to sort of abstract away details of TLS, SSH, IKE, kind of like the network communication protocols that we use. And so here, I guess the diagram of Alice is you, the user, and then we have Bob, some host that she wants to connect to. And most of these protocols, you start by doing some kind of key exchange, usually Diffie-Hellman, and then you authenticate the key exchange using some digital signatures. It could be one-way or it could be bidirectional authentication. And then after doing this handshake, you switch to doing some kind of symmetric authenticated encryption mode, AES with whatever mode you want. So this is this big picture. And the important part for this talk of this picture is that we have this key exchange algorithm. Oh, I have this thing. And a digital signature that's happening. The reason why we do this kind of cryptography is that there are many places where you have some kind of network interference. And so the cryptography is intended to protect against this sort of network interference. This I discovered when EduRoom was not working this morning. Anyway, the cryptography that we use for this kind of public key, these public key operations, the key exchange and the digital signatures, is actually quite old, the mathematical assumptions underlying them. So the first paper published in public key cryptography was the Diffie and Hellman paper from 1976. They introduced the discrete log assumption. And that is still in use for both key exchange and digital signatures. Integer factorization was published like a year later by the RSA paper. And that, in theory, can be used for public key encryption, but is not really used for that anymore. It's mostly used for digital signatures. But that is the pervasive digital signature algorithm in use. And then in the mid-1980s, the elliptic curve discrete log assumption was formulated, and that can also be used for key exchange and signatures. And those are basically the three mathematical assumptions underlying all public key cryptography in use on the internet today. This is going to change very soon, and it is in the process of changing now. The first sentence of the Diffie and Hellman paper. How many of you actually read the Diffie and Hellman paper? Half the audience. Everybody who hasn't read this paper, I mean, it's amazing to go back and read it from like a modern perspective. So if you haven't read it, you should totally read it. Right? So the first sentence of this paper, which like not many of us actually have the ability to write in a paper, is we stand today on the brink of a revolution in cryptography. And they were completely correct, and it was not like just ego that they got to write this, right? This is like one of the foundational papers of like the last century. And we stand today on the brink of another revolution in cryptography, which is that we are about to trash all of these assumptions and have new post-quantum ones, right? So I put this slide in. I felt obligated to put this slide in because everything else that I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk is completely classical cryptography. But it's about to go away. So we are in the midst of deploying the quantum-resistant algorithms that have been standardized by NIST. So there are some new assumptions that are coming out that are believed to be secure against quantum computers, so like module LWE hash-based signatures, N-true. These are the current algorithms. It is going to be a bumpy road because we are discovering, thanks to cryptanalysis, facts last minute about some of these algorithms that are a little bit awkward. So a couple of papers came out, both in 2022, very late in the NIST standardization process. One of them breaking supersingular isogeny Diffie-Hellman. And not only was it broken by quantum computers, it's broken classically in 10 minutes on a single core, which is like really awkward given how that this assumption had been around for at least a decade and that people had been building all sorts of fancy crypto schemes on it. And then a second paper, Breaking Rainbow Takes a Weekend on a Laptop, took out the most promising of the multivariate quadratic schemes. So they're working on replacements for this. But this is the kind of amazing progress that shows that you can have decades of work on cryptography based off of some assumption, and the assumption turns out to be wrong the moment that somebody actually looks at it and understands it deeply. So this is going to be an interesting time. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, we're going to go all the way back to 1976 and talk about RSA. And I'm doing this because, I don't know, I like RSA. It's easy. We teach it to our undergrads, right? And like, there's a version that half of you teach to your undergrads as well. So the sort of textbook RSA, and I'm going to specialize in signatures because that's basically what we use RSA for. So we don't even bother with the encryption part anymore. So hopefully you have all seen this before because we're going to do versions of this getting fancier and fancier over the course of the talk. Okay, so an RSA key, in theory, you start by generating two primes, P and Q, say 1024 bits each, multiply them together, that's your public modulus. In your key, you have an encryption exponent, everybody uses 65537. Your decryption exponent is E inverse mod phi of N. Okay, that's your public key, your private key. And then to generate a signature, you hash your message, you pad it. The details of padding will be important later, but everybody, you can imagine just some kind of fixed string, and then you raise it to the dth power mod n, that's your secret exponent d. That's your signature, send it over to verify it, you raise your signature to the eth power mod n. Okay, so this is textbook RSA, I have added the padding and hashing bit, and this is what everybody does in every protocol on the internet now. Okay, and it's amazing that this hasn't changed that much since 1976. And in fact, the details of the padding and the hashing haven't changed since the 1990s. Okay, so sort of to put this in context, we all think, okay, RSA is secure. And in fact, the reason we think RSA is secure is that we don't have a good way to compute the secret exponent D unless you know the factorization of N. So, okay, RSA is based off of the hardness of factoring. And so here we have this picture of, we have like the rays of mathematics shining down upon like a tower of abstraction within computer science. We have like algorithms producing cryptography, producing security, and then this is what we actually use to secure our computers. So here's the picture. And then the tower of assumptions here, well, At the highest theoretical level, we still don't know whether P is equal to or not equal to NP. And it seems like we have very little chance of resolving this anytime soon, or even resolving like where on in Pagliacci's five worlds we actually live, whether you can have cryptography. Even outside of that, the factoring problem itself is probably not NP-hard. If it is NP-hard, the polynomial hierarchy collapses, and we are, which is sort of unlikely unless you think that like something close to P. Actually, I don't remember what the some like resolution to P versus NP. Even outside of that, despite the fact that the RSA problem is like 47 years old, we still don't have a provable equivalence or non-equivalence of the hardness of breaking RSA and factorization, which is amazing, right? Everybody knows that RSA is based off of factoring, and yet this is not a provable statement. It hasn't been proved. It could be proved. Even given that, there are sub-exponential time factoring algorithms, which is why RSA keys have to be so large, so much larger than, say, elliptic curve keys. So we're already sort of chipping away at the foundations here on a mathematical level. Then on a sort of more implementation level, when you design your protocols, you need to choose specific parameters, and you choose them hopefully to evade all known attacks. You have to decide on some kind of padding function, you have to decide on some kind of choice of hash function. Then you embed your cryptographic algorithm into a protocol and hopefully use it in a secure way. And then when you actually implement it, you have to do things like generate random numbers. Hopefully you've done that right. And then even if you write this beautiful protocol, this gets given to developers, and the developers have to actually implement this, and they read the protocol and they make mistakes, and users make mistakes, and then sort of at the bottom physical level, we have just that computers are physical devices that have physical phenomena like errors. So we have this whole tower of things that can go wrong with our algorithms. So this is the perspective that I want to take in how to break things. And we have kind of an amazing variety of like layers of abstraction here. Okay. So this is an XKCD cartoon that I feel obligated to show every time I talk about RSA. So the first part of this cartoon is a crypto nerd's imagination. His laptop's encrypted. Let's build a $1 million cluster to crack it. No good. It's 4096-bit RSA. Blast. Our evil plan is foiled. Well, okay, we can ask what that actually looks like. Whoa, the colors are... Oh, okay, it's just this monitor. Okay. So what this actually looks like in practice is if you wanted to break factorization using the best known algorithm, the best algorithm that we have is the number field sieve. This is an algorithm that dates to the early 1990s. It was developed by a number of people. It is a complex algorithm with multiple stages, and it relies on a set of number theoretic heuristic assumptions. There are a couple of high-performance implementations of this algorithm, and every 10 years or so, you can see, a consortium of a bunch of people get together, pool their computing resources, and do another factorization record. So the progress has looked something like this. Okay, 512-bit RSA was factored in 1999. 768-bit RSA was done in 2009. 829-bit RSA was done in 2020. So that's the current record. A back-of-the-envelope calculation says that 1024-bit RSA would be, if you just sort of take these numbers and or if you take these computation time and plug it into the asymptotic formula for the number field sieve, would be about 500,000 core years without any algorithmic improvements. This is eminently doable by any large organization and has been doable for more than 10 years now, probably. The only reason it hasn't been done by academics is that the handful of people who are actually working on this problem don't currently have access to this much computing power. That is the only thing keeping it from happening. I don't know how many of you have done sort of this kind of cryptanalysis work, but what it looks like to babysit a computation for 6 months or a year or two. Has anybody babysat a computation for like 6 months or a year or two? It's a drag. Like you, especially, you know, you imagine that like you have an international team and everybody has like a couple of racks of servers and you're trying to like coordinate this thing going back and forth. Basically, you sit there and you like watch the output and then a disk dies and you have to like restart the job. And so getting the developer time and the sysadmin time to just sit there, sysadmin time being like a researcher has to actually just sit there and like sysadmin the machines that they're running to do this, it's a pain. And the amount of computing power costs a lot of money. So, but that is literally the only thing that's happening, that's keeping this from like more progress from happening. So people somehow think that factoring is a super well-studied problem, but in fact, no, it's studied by five underpaid French people, and that's it right now. I just want to scare you a little bit. This is old news, but okay, so the asymptotic running time of the general number field sieve, the best algorithm that we have for factoring, is this horrid-looking expression, which it has this L function which appears in every number theoretic algorithm that uses estimates coming from the prime number theorem. We don't really necessarily care about the details, but we've got this like exponential in like log n to the 1/3, log n to the 2/3, and then we've got this like horrid looking constant like cube root of 64 over 9. This number has been the same since the early 1990s. This is also the same running time for prime field discrete log, and it was the same running time for all discrete log over finite fields until from the early 1990s until 2013, when a series of improvements took this running time from this to essentially quasi-polynomial time, so like n to the big O of log n. And this was not just a theoretical improvement. They've now been able to compute discrete logarithms in fields of size like 6,000 bits. And this was this improvement just came out of, you know, I think one major insight plus a series of small improvements. And I just want to say, even a very small improvement in the number field sieve running time would have a large impact on RSA key sizes. So for example, there's a version of this algorithm which has a constant that's cube root of 32 over 9 rather than cube root of 64 over 9 for this constant here. And that only applies, as far as we know, in special cases. But this is doable for special form 1024-bit integers just on academic resources. And if there was an improvement in this 1/3 to like a 1/4, just back of the envelope, depending on what this constant is, this could take out 2048-bit RSA. That's how close we are to, like, the key sizes are to these kinds of algorithmic improvements. So the only reason I think that this hasn't happened, it could be that this is fundamentally the true running time of factorization, but just aesthetically, if you look at this running time, does this seem like the proper running time for such a fundamental problem? I don't think so, but, you know. Anyway, so all of this rests on the heads of five underpaid French people. Here's another XKCD cartoon, and this is, I think, kind of the state of a lot of cryptanalysis, that we have, like, all of our modern cryptographic infrastructure, and then there's, like, a piece of academic software that is maintained by five underpaid French people. I just wanted to scare people a little bit. Okay, so here's the other half of the other XKCD cartoon that I was showing you. So instead of blast or evil plan is foiled, trying to factor RSA the hard way, what would actually happen, since this is kind of a security audience, is his laptop's encrypted, drug him and hit him with his $5 wrench until he tells us the password. That's how you actually break things. You don't break the cryptography outright. You do the easier thing. This is how you actually do threat modeling. So I am a cryptography person still. So I don't hit people with $5 wrenches. I hit algorithms with $5 wrenches. So there will be no violence in this talk, except to algorithms. Okay. Now I'm going to go back to something that I did 12 years ago. So maybe you've heard me give a talk about this before. It will only be 5 minutes, and then we'll move on to new stuff. But I want to show you the algorithmic $5 wrench, which is, we just spent a lot of time talking about how complicated factoring is. But it turns out that, well, RSA moduli have a bunch of nice algebraic properties. So for example, if we have two RSA moduli, modulus 1 is the product of some prime p times some other prime q1, and modulus 2 is the product of some prime p times some other prime q2, you can compute the GCD of modulus 1 and modulus 2 and get out p. And the important difference in doing this is that the amount of time that it takes to compute the GCD for two 1024-bit RSA moduli is like 15 microseconds, where, of course, our back-of-the-envelope estimate for the outright time to factor each of these was like 500,000 core years. So this is an important difference. Now, I'm saying this, but of course, this should never work as a real-world factoring algorithm, right? You can imagine doing an experiment. So we collect a bunch of RSA moduli, and they're randomly chosen from a collection of primes. And if you tried computing the pairwise GCDs of all of these, this should never result in a non-trivial common divisor. So the back of the envelope estimate here is that, okay, you have like two randomly chosen primes per RSA modulus. The prime number theorem tells us that we have about like 10 to the 150 512-bit primes. And so we have a balls and bins problem. So we have like 2m primes, prime balls being thrown into 10 to the 150 bins. And so the probability of a non-trivial common divisor is this function, which like doesn't become anything approaching a constant until we have like m being about square root of p. And so if we plot this function, it's basically zero until square root of p, which is pretty close to the number of atoms in the universe. So this says that if you were building a, say like a certificate infrastructure for an Internet of Things where every atom had their own certificate, you shouldn't use 1024-bit RSA. But beyond that, you're like probably fine. So here is the research program that we have for the rest of the talk, which is, I've been calling it shooting cryptographic fish in a barrel. So if you think of some mistake that somebody might have made, no matter how unlikely it seems, so for example, finding RSA moduli with shared factors, and then you collect a bunch of data from a bunch of implementations. So you can do this by scanning the internet, by checking certificate transparency logs, by setting up a network tap at your institution, those kinds of things. And then you just check if somebody managed to screw it up. You will find somebody who screwed it up. And if you haven't found somebody who screwed it up, it's that you haven't collected enough data yet. And you can just sit collecting data until you find somebody screwed it up. And then you write a paper. And then you're good. Okay. So if you do this experiment for RSA keys with common divisors, it turns out to work way better than you expect it to. And in fact, it has continued to work for more than 10 years and has factored large numbers of keys. So we have, 12 years ago, there were a large number of HTTPS certificates that shared keys, SSH servers whose host keys shared common factors, some PGP users, some smart card generated keys that were in certificates for a Taiwanese citizen smart card deployment, more SSH, some Tor relay public keys, and even in 2022, Google set up a project to look for this among a number of errors in certificate transparency logs, and they found a couple thousand keys that had common factors. So this is a problem that is not going away. Okay, so I just told you that this should never happen, and then I've told you that this happens rampantly on the internet and is not going away. So what happened was that what we found was widespread random number generation failures on low resource devices. So nearly all of the keys that were compromised in this way either had some kind of basic vulnerability in their software or some kind of hardware failure. And the basic pattern is that they failed to see the random number generator before generating their keys. And what happened is that if you hadn't seeded your random number generator yet when you generated your first RSA prime, and then seeding did go through at some point while you were generating your second prime, then the first prime would be the same and the second prime would be different on different machine and on different devices. And so the most common failure mode was a problem with the Linux random number generator in combination with how OpenSSL was generating RSA keys. So the picture here is that you have this sort of like tower of random number generation. So you have sort of hardware sources of entropy going into, like, you being used to seed the Linux random number generator, which was then used to seed the OpenSSL application random number generator, which was then used to generate RSA keys. And if you think about a little network device, they often automatically generate their crypto keys on first boot. A little Wi-Fi router lacks all of the entropy sources that were assumed by the Linux random number generator at the time. And that meant that on many of these devices, the Linux random number generator had not yet been seeded when it was queried by OpenSSL. So this was patched in 2012. And in 2022, Jason Dornenfeld did a lot of work trying to randomize the entire design of the Linux random number generator. Some of that was rolled back because of performance issues. So I think the progress is like ongoing. But just because this was patched doesn't mean that the problem went away. So this is a plot from a follow-up paper that some students of mine did several years after this. So we went through a ton of work to try to notify more than 60 vendors of this vulnerability. Some of them acknowledged and pushed out patches. Some of them did not acknowledge and pushed out patches. But the Linux random number, the Linux kernel had been patched. So in theory, you would think that this vulnerability would go away. But if you look at the number of vulnerable hosts over time, and sort of starting around 2012, there were regular network scans happening of HTTPS, so we could have some visibility into like the long-term trends here. The number of vulnerable hosts kept going up, and here there's some differences due to like different scanning methodologies, but you can see that the number of vulnerable hosts is continuing to go up. And this is in part because manufacturers are introducing newly vulnerable products over time. So doing all this work of disclosure, somehow this vulnerability kept getting reintroduced, often because they were using some old kernel version. Those of you who have tried to do disclosure know how difficult it is. So also in doing this paper, it ended up being sort of an unintentional experiment on disclosure. And this is what it looks like to try to disclose to like 60 companies. Half of them just never respond at all. And then some of them respond and put out a public advisory, and some of them respond privately but don't actually like ever put out a public advisory of any kind. So I think the disclosure process has changed over the years in that many vendors now have a more formal process and they understand that external security researchers find vulnerabilities, but it's still extremely fraught And we have something under disclosure right now, and I think it is much easier to go through an organization like CERT if they will acknowledge you. So this is one piece of advice that I have for you is that trying to disclose things to vendors is very difficult. Okay, so that's setting the stage for some more recent work that I want to talk about. So if we go back to our picture of textbook RSA signature generation, the picture that we have is, so we have a signature being generated as a padded message hash to the D mod N, and then verification, we just take the signature to the E and check if it's equal to the padded message hash. Now, most implementations use the Chinese remainder theorem to implement RSA signature generation. So using the Chinese remainder theorem just means that we do two modular exponentiations of half size, one of them mod P and one of them mod Q, and then we combine them to get the answer mod N. And that's the signature that you actually send over the wire. Right? So this is a common implementation optimization. It gives you something like a factor 8 of 8 improvement in the time to do modular exponentiation. Now, there is a classic side channel or classic fault attack against this kind of RSA signature generation. And in this fault attack, what happens is if there is an error in one of these half exponent generations, so like if the signature generated mod P is correct and the signature generated mod Q is incorrect, and then the implementation just blindly combines them using the Chinese remainder theorem, then they will send over an incorrect incorrect signature over the wire, and an eavesdropper who can see the signature can then take the signature, raise it to the eth power, then they have something that is equal to M mod P and not equal to M mod Q, and so then they can just compute the GCD of this difference with N and then discover one of the prime factors of N and factor N that way. And as we've seen, computing GCDs is super efficient. Right? So this is a very old and classic vulnerability. The mitigation for this is to validate RSA signatures after you send them. This is well known and it's implemented in most common libraries. So the history of this vulnerability goes all the way back to Bonnet, DeMillo, and Lipton, who wrote the first paper in 1997 on fault attacks against cryptography. And then shortly after they published their paper, Lenstra gave an improvement, which is the version that I just gave to you. So starting in 1998, there were basically decades of papers showing how to exploit this in the context of side channel attacks. So if you want to evaluate the security of a smart card, you glitch it with a laser or something while it's doing RSA signature generation and then carry out this attack. And so in this threat model, implementations must validate signatures before they are sent over the wire, right? Or before they exit the device. This was patched in OpenSSL in 2001, so a long time ago. However, in 2015, there was this super cool white paper put out by Florian Weimer, who did a bunch of network scanning of TLS hosts and found implementations that were generating bad signatures in an untriggered fault mode. Like he just connected to them via TLS, got bad signatures, and got their secret keys. And he observed that like most of the cryptographic libraries that were in common use, except for OpenSSL, were unprotected against this attack. So in 2015, most of the common cryptographic libraries implemented the countermeasure to validate signatures before sending them. And then in 2022, I and a student and some collaborators were looking at the traffic on our networks and found bad signatures that were vulnerable to this attack. So the way that the exploit for this works in practice is it relies on PKCS number 1v1.5 padding. So this is a horrible name, but this is the most common RSA signature padding still for TLS 1.2 and below. TLS 1.2 is becoming less and less common over time, but it is still about half of the TLS traffic on our network at UCSD. TLS 1.3 requires randomized padding for signatures, but I think it is still allowed to use PKCS number 1v1.5 for certificates for TLS 1.3. So the important thing about this padding scheme is that it is deterministic. And the padding, it looks like basically you have your hashed message, you have some metadata that identifies the hash, this is just a fixed value, you have a 0 byte, then you basically fill the rest of the space up to get a value that's about the size of your modulus n with 1 byte or 1 bits. Then you have like a one byte that is identifying the type of hashing and a 0 byte just to make sure that you don't overflow anything. So all of this is deterministic and known. So the hash is the only thing that changes message to message. And in TLS 1.2, the protocol handshake that is done, so the, say, key exchange and the signature that the server is using to authenticate itself using the key exchange, is all done in the clear. And if it's using PKCS number 1v1.5 padding, this is this padding part is all deterministic. And that means that an attacker has the entire value that is used to compute the signature, because the hash is over values that are completely known. And so this GCD computation is completely trivial for an attacker who can view the handshake that is going over the wire. So going back to our research program, we can think of some mistake that an attacker might have made. So for example, having a fault in their RSA key generation or RSA signature generation, you can collect a bunch of signatures. And I want to talk a little bit about the difficulty of doing that. You can check for the error, you can find someone who screwed up, and then you can write a paper. Okay, so I mentioned a little bit about active scanning, and I think active scanning has been a well-studied aspect of security research for 10 to 15 years now. The first sort of full IPv4 scans were done around 2009-2010, and fast scanning tools were published, say TCP scanning tools were published around 2013, and so there are multiple options if you want to scan the entire visible IPv4 space for some protocol. It may cause some errors, or like it may cause some difficulty with your institution, depending on their policies and whether or not they understand doing this kind of network research. But it's fairly well understood. Something that is interesting that I have been working on doing, but turns out to be much more difficult, is passive network analysis. So in theory, there are existing tools that can do this. And the way that you would do this is you could say, get your system, like network administrators, to agree to let you have access at your institution to some data. You could split your network traffic to some analysis machine that you have. And then there are software tools like Zeek, formerly known as Bro, that will do, say, TCP flow reconstruction and protocol parsing. And then you can pull out the data that you're looking for and store and analyze it. In practice, this is much more difficult than what I just said, especially for doing this kind of research. So of course, there are like ethical, legal, and privacy issues you may have to deal with. In the US, we have IRBs, whatever the local analog of an institutional review board that you deal with. The existing tools either scale poorly, so BroZeek is reliable, but you need a large number of machines to cope with large amounts of network traffic. There are theoretical academic improvements on this, but they're unreliable because it turns out that doing all of the sort of dealing with all the TCP stuff and all the protocol stuff is very hard to do at scale. Part of this is that debugging is hard in a real-world environment. So finding all of the weird things that go on in networks, you eliminate them one by one. It's very painful. And the final thing is that it's very difficult. I mean, you can't really share this data. It's very privacy sensitive. So even if you anonymize it, we all know how bad anonymization is. It's hard to get access to. It's hard to share. And then even when you do have data that you can analyze, in a real protocol context, you may have very limited metadata. You may or may not be able to see things like certificates or SNI or even IP addresses. And so if you see a weird handshake that goes over the wire, trying to figure out what it is, it's much more difficult if you aren't actively connecting to the machine yourself. So this is difficult. And I put this plot here. This is actually a plot that we put in the paper. And this shows you kind of how hard it is. So the blue dashed is the amount of traffic that we were seeing at the UCSD networks. And the red is my collaborators at CU Boulder. So you can see that their machine was down a lot of the time. But they sometimes got more data. And then here, okay, this was 2022, and in January, the entire university got shut down because of the Omicron wave. And so you can see that there was very little traffic on the network, and then it sort of came back when things came back. And then the next quarter that started here, we actually had much more traffic because there were many more students on campus. We had sort of real-world logistical issues limiting the amount of data that we had access to. Okay, so given all the caveats of, like, this is not a reliable statistical sample, still, we were able to collect TLS data on our networks for 8 months. We saw almost 6 billion TLS handshakes. We validated 2.7 billion signatures. Of those, 1,700 of them were invalid RSA signatures. And of those 1,700 invalid ones, there were 11 that resulted in a factored RSA public key. And these vulnerable signatures, in fact, resulted in 3 distinct certificate keys, all from different domain names belonging to Baidu.com. So Baidu is the Google of China. So this is kind of a significant key to have gotten. We were able to talk to some people at Baidu, and what they communicated was that their infrastructure, the way that they do TLS, is very similar to the way that a lot of large organizations do TLS, which is that they offload signature generation to hardware accelerators. So they have kind of a front-end library that was using their custom hardware implementation to do RSA key generation or RSA signature generation. And then these signatures were like processed back through the library, even though they were using something based off of Go, the way that they were using it was bypassing the existing software checks for RSA signatures. And it appears that their custom implementation was not validating the signatures before they were being sent back through this library path. In fact, the particular pattern of the failures that we saw, this is the total number of connections that we saw going to Baidu-associated domains from the vulnerable keys, and then we saw just a handful of signatures that were vulnerable just over the course of a week, and then they disappeared. So this appeared to be just a flaw that was present perhaps in a single dying FPGA that then completely died or was removed from the data center, and then we never saw a problem again. So this is this kind of transient issue. And this is the sort of thing that if we had just done a single connection to Baidu.com, we would not have likely seen a vulnerable signature. So it was only because we saw this large amount of traffic from presumably kind of their entire data center over the course of months that we were able to see this kind of rare flaw. Okay, we also did some active scans to see what we could find there. And in our active scans, we found a number of other devices that were vulnerable. The majority of them were Cisco ASA devices. And what we saw, okay, so each column here is a distinct factored key. And so you can see that once we see like one bad signature, we saw it in every single scan, essentially. Some of them were a little bit more transient going up and down, and some other implementations seemed to be like completely transient. But for many of these, it looked like the hardware just completely failed, and then we never got a valid signature from these devices. Some of these were devices that had been loaded with, say, wildcard certificates for the entire domain of an organization, because they were like, say, VPN products. The thing that is somewhat unexpected here is the persistence of these errors. So what we thought that we might find in doing this kind of research is like, say, you know, a gamma ray hits some RAM and causes like a sporadic error. We thought maybe we would see like these very sporadic errors. But in fact, what we see is that somehow hardware is dying, and then the fact that the hardware is dying is just spewing out people's private keys consistently over the internet. So was not quite expecting how common failing hardware was. The hardware failure aspect, I have no idea if we're actually seeing, you know, sporadic failures due to things like cosmic rays, because the hardware failures are so much more common that they are sort of outweighing everything else that we're seeing. So I want to put this in a little bit more of a historical surveillance context. So if you go back to, say, 15 years ago, and you think about organizations that had visibility into network traffic 15 years ago, this would have been ideal for surveilling TLS traffic. So back 15 years ago, when, say, TLS 1.1 and 1.2 were dominating the internet, RSA keys were used both for signatures and for key exchange. And you would use the same certificate key either to do a signature if you were doing a Diffie-Hellman key exchange, or to for the client browser to encrypt the pre-master secret and send it to the server. And so if someone doing this kind of passive network analysis had viewed a single faulty signature that revealed the secret key, they could then go back and decrypt all of the key exchanges that were using RSA encryption and get the pre-master secret, and then use that to decrypt the actual content of the traffic. And so this would have been extremely convenient, and some of the documents in the Snowden slides, which have been public now for 11 plus years, make it clear that multiple countries were both tracking TLS, and that they had vulnerabilities that they were testing against RSA moduli. So the fact that most libraries in use on the internet did not patch until 2015 means that until then, probably a large fraction of internet traffic was actually vulnerable to this kind of vulnerability. So, but this is true for TLS, say, 1.2 and below. And so If we analyze sort of what an attacker needs to carry out this attack, the basic GCD attack that I outlined, we need to have a bad signature coming from the server, we need to know what the hashed message is, and we need to use deterministic padding for RSA. So this was true in the TLS 1.2 and below context. And so that means that we can attack this protocol passively. TLS 1.3, we actually don't have any of these things. So the signatures are actually coming from the server, are encrypted because the entire handshake is encrypted after you do the first Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So a passive network attacker can't even view this signature. They also don't know the hash of the message because it includes things that a passive attacker wouldn't be able to view. And then the signature scheme is using non-deterministic padding. And so the fact that the attacker would need to have deterministic padding to carry out this attack also is failed. So we can't, TLS 1.3 is fine from this perspective. SSH protocol, the handshake that is done in SSH is actually done in the clear, and you don't change to encrypted traffic until after you finish the public key handshake. So the signature for SSH is sent in the clear. But the hashed message includes the Diffie-Hellman shared secret. And so a passive network attacker would just see the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, but they don't know the shared secret, so they can't compute the message hash. So they can't do a GCD and get the secret key, even if a bad signature is sent. But the signature padding for RSA in SSH is often done using PKCS number 1v1.5, so we do have deterministic padding. So the SSH protocol was previously thought to be safe against this kind of fault attack, but it turns out that it is not, and we can overcome the problem of the hash message contains the Diffie-Hellman shared secret. So if we go back to PKCS number 1v1.5 signature padding, we have this deterministic fixed thing, and then the hash of the message, which in SSH the attacker doesn't know. But this is like relatively small compared to N. So we have this big thing that the attacker knows that's a prefix, and this kind of small little hash. So I want to show you how we can actually exploit this. So here's a toy version of this. So I'm going to generate a completely legitimate 2048-bit RSA modulus, so 1024-bit prime P, 1024-bit prime Q, N is P times Q, and E is 65537. Now, I thought I had better things. Okay, so I am going to just compute some fixed padding, so this is just going to be like all 1 bits, and then I'm just going to generate a random value that I'm going to have a stand-in for the hash, because I didn't feel like computing a real hash. So this is a random value. So my message is going to be my padding appended to the hash. And so if I look at this message, I have like a bunch of 1 bits and then like this random hash value. And so if I have a bad signature, I'm going to call it bad underscore s. So bad underscore s is correct mod p. So if I take bad underscore s and raise it to the eth power mod p, that's equal to m. But it's incorrect mod q. So bad underscore s to the e mod q is not equal to m. So I have my bad signature, which is correct mod p and incorrect mod q. And I would like to recover p just from this bad signature. So the thing that I'm going to do, I'm going to generate a value just from what an attacker might be able to see publicly. So I have my bad signature, I have my modulus n, that's the public key, and e is just a public key. And so I just compute this value, which is the difference between like the bad signature and the pad, which is also just like a fixed value. And then I compute a value that's like about the size of the unknown hash. I'm going to generate a matrix from just public values. I'm going to LLL reduce that. I construct a degree 2 polynomial from the shortest vector that I got out of my LLL reduced lattice. I compute the first root of this value, and then I compute the greatest common divisor of that added to this a and n, and I got my factor p out again. So this is lattice-based cryptanalysis, which many people think is very complicated and hard, and I just did it in a screen on using Sage. And this takes less than a second. In fact, generating the primes p and q is the most expensive part of this entire computation. Okay, so this is a generalization of Coppersmith and Halgrave-Graham's theorem, which the way to remember this is that given half of the bits, most or least significant bits of p, where p is a prime factor of n, that is, say, half of the size of n, you can factor n in polynomial time. So in this case, we're given something that is, that we just have to add a small value to get a, and then that has a common divisor that is large enough with n. So this is a scary looking theorem, but in its simplest version, it is in fact just this. So our research program, again, we are going to collect SSH handshake signatures, we're going to run the lattice attack, we're going to find someone who screwed this up, and then we're going to write a paper. So how do we collect SSH data? It turns out that if you look at passive SSH data on at least our network, it is almost all Russian scanning, like malware scanning, and not very much real SSH traffic. So it is like vastly disproportionate, just like people trying to brute force passwords for SSH servers. So it's not, we didn't have enough traffic for the passive analysis part to be interesting. So we're stuck with active scans. So we got some historical scan data from between 2017 and 2020, and then we did some of our own scanning. And you can see that RSA is becoming less common. So ECDSA is becoming much, much, much more common among SSH servers. And here's kind of the flowchart of the attack. So we have a signature. If it was invalid, we ran the lattice attack, and we were able to get private keys for 189 unique keys from about 5,000 signatures where the lattice attack succeeds. And this lattice computation took about 0.1 seconds for common parameter settings. Interestingly, the affected vendors included many of the same ones that we saw for TLS. So they were presumably using the same custom implementation. Okay, so the analysis of the impact of this vulnerability is very different for SSH than for TLS. So for TLS, we saw that historically this was a really bad problem because of the prevalence of RSA key exchange. For SSH, the keys that we were able to compromise are the host keys that are used to authenticate the server to the client. Client authentication is done later inside of the encrypted channel. And so this has nothing to do with the security of SSH client implementation. So the only thing that an attacker can do with this vulnerability is be able to impersonate an SSH server to a client. But of course, we all know that when you see your, like when you SSH into a server and you see, oh no, you have a different host key, you just go, oh man, and then you delete it, and then you like reconnect, right? Nobody ever does like SSH host key validation anyway. So, you know, I'm sure there's some scenario where this is an interesting thing. Anyway, so I am almost done here, but I have learned that when I give a talk about these kinds of vulnerabilities, that I need to end on a positive note, because otherwise everybody gets all like devastated that everything is just broken all the time. So in fact, there is good news. So as we've seen, TLS 1.3 has been specifically designed to be less vulnerable to passive cryptanalysis. So in particular, the handshake is encrypted after the initial key exchange. And in fact, I think they're rolling out encrypted client hellos also so that you hide metadata like SNI. RSA key exchange has been removed entirely. So passive analysis, basically all you can see is the Diffie-Hellman key exchange and some of the Cypher Suite information. You don't even see see signatures anymore. If you want to get data from TLS 1.3, you can still collect data from active scans. And then, of course, the mitigations, even beyond TLS 1.3, you can do a number of things. So as we've seen, it's very important to validate any signatures before they're sent over the wire. This is the kind of thing that if you are implementing RSA for the first time, you don't think about, but is clearly very important, even in a non-hardware context, because we've seen that basically even these software implementations can be vulnerable. PKCS number 1 v1.5 is known to be a disaster for encryption padding. It is also, even though it is provably secure for signature padding, this kind of attack shows how fragile it can be. So TLS 1.3 uses RSA PSS for handshake signatures, so that is also a good choice. And in general, I don't know, RSA, I love attacking RSA. It's so fun. I don't think there's any good justification for using RSA in 2024, honestly. It's just, I don't know. It's attacking, it's fun. Anyway, so kind of the bigger picture of all of these vulnerabilities is that these kinds of vulnerabilities are things that are crossing abstraction boundaries. So we're taking like the mathematical properties of the ciphers themselves and then finding these vulnerabilities in random number generators or like hardware failures that result in mathematical properties. And so this is the kind of thing that's very difficult to detect during routine testing. You can't really test whether your random number generator is working. Despite the fact that I'm hating on RSA a little bit, I mean, I love RSA, but I could have given a similar talk about these kinds of mathematical structural things in Diffie-Hellman or ECDSA, the other things that are commonly used. It's not that RSA is specifically more vulnerable to these things. Even though I said that RSA should go away, it is likely going to be around for the long haul because even though we're moving to quantum-resistant algorithms, the best way to deploy them is in hybrid mode with classical algorithms for the foreseeable future because you never know when somebody's going to come up with a polynomial time classical algorithm for module like LWE, right? Maybe there. I see some sad faces in the audience. It'll take a while before we have four decades of confidence in the algorithm. Anyway, so in conclusion, despite the fact that we think that our cryptography is super well studied, it turns out that if you look, you can find cryptographic vulnerabilities that are hiding in plain sight. So you just need to look in the right way. This is also an example of how some very simple math can get you some very non-trivial things. It's also an example of how our cryptographic primitives can be very fragile to implementation mistakes. So one little failure to validate can reveal the TLS keys for like one of the largest internet companies in the world. So with that, that is all I have. And if you wanted to read any of these papers, here are the ones that I have.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.